Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. We are going to dive right into part two of Dr. Scott McKnight's talk. So if you haven't listened to part one, pause right now, back up, and start there. In this episode, Scott goes into more depth on what exactly trauma is and what we have to learn about coping with trauma from none other than Apostle Paul. This is part two of Scott McKnight's December 2024 talk, Trauma and the Pastor.
Trauma has three elements. It's a response to an event, an experience, a culture, a church, a relationship. It's a response that overwhelms and affects, even threatens a person's identity, security, and safety. Laura Anderson, in her new book on When Religion Hurts You, if you haven't read that book, if you're a leader, a pastor in a church, you should have it on your shelf for easy reference, and it's a book very much worth reading. She talks about adverse religious experiences. She unravels trauma, I think, a little bit differently, and it's helpful. She says, trauma is anything that is too much, too soon, or too fast that undermines our normal ability to cope and return to a sense of safety. Trauma is not what happened to you, and this is really critical. Trauma is not what happened to you, but your body and nervous system's response to what happened to you. It's a response in the system. So therefore, trauma is subjective. What is traumatic for one person may not be traumatic for another. It is also perceptive. There does not have to be an actual threat or danger in front of you. If you're afraid of going down to Chicago at night and you just happen to be there at night and you get out of your car, you might all of a sudden have anxiety and there's nothing to be afraid of. But there's a lot of crime in certain spots in Chicago, and a lot of people are afraid of Chicago because of it. It's perceptive. In other words, it's something we perceive. Whether it's reality or not doesn't matter. Finally, it's embodied. Trauma, it is often said, is stored in the body and not in the mind, which means our body can suddenly react to a situation that perceives a re-traumatization or a sense that we may not be secure or safe. I would also like to add the term memory. Our body has a memory. Trauma is connected to memory, that we remember something that's happened. Something can stimulate something that happens. Nancy French, who is a New York Times best-selling author and investigative journalist, is on her Twitter, which is now called X, and I don't even know if she's still on Twitter, announced to her friends, one of whom is my wife, Chris, that she was about to begin the Red Devil chemo for her cancer treatment. All right? She wrote, side effects are serious. If I cry, it'll be red tears. So please pray. All right? That's what she wrote. All right. Now, this was interesting because Samuel Perry, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Oklahoma, haunts the Twitter world, very effectively, I might say. He responded to Nancy with these words, stay strong, Nancy. We've been there. I'd say my wife could go on and on about the red devil Andreamycin, but she can't without wanting to vomit, literally. Doesn't even like the sight of red liquid like Kool-Aid or cough medicine. So Sam Perry's wife remembers trauma that was experienced because of her cancer treatments. So trauma is tricky and it's complicated And it's in need of very serious investigation and of our understanding of it in churches. So Adrian Gibson, who I'm writing this book with, very cleverly grouped our book into four major R's, the four R's of a trauma-safe church. I can't take any credit for this, but I'll probably get credit for it. And I won't say I got it from Adrian, but I will tell you. Realize what trauma is. Realize what trauma is. So we need to understand it. Second, recognize the symptoms of trauma. And we'll get into that. Respond with trauma-informed culture and care. Churches are not good at this. Some churches are, but a lot of times we have not been good at this, is that we can run roughshod over people who've been traumatized. And there are a lot of people in our churches who are looking for the God of grace and healing in our church services, and we can say things as leaders and preachers and teachers that re-traumatize them. And we can say, I did not intend to do that, but it doesn't make any difference. It happened. And we need to own that and become more responsible for learning to talk about things that would be trauma sensitive. So the third R is important. And that then is to respond with trauma-informed culture and care. And then we need to resist re-traumatizing people. Resist. Now, one of the things I would like to say is that many leaders in churches have been traumatized. And churches are not going to become more trauma sensitive unless leaders in churches lead the way. So I believe pastors, you can become a beachhead of creating trauma sensitive spaces on the basis of the trauma that you have experienced. You'll be able to say, this is what happens when someone's been traumatized and they hear you say, something strong in a doctrine of hierarchy. And they'll go, that triggers for me some horrible experiences I've had with some pastors and leaders. So we need to be, we can become the leaders in this on the basis of leaders who have been traumatized. And I'm going to say that the Apostle Paul can help. Now, I'm not saying he did everything right, but I think you might be surprised by some of the things that happens with Paul. All right. So I'd first like to look at the vulnerable Paul, because I don't think he's perceived that way. In 1 Corinthians, I'm going to read some verses. 1 Corinthians 4:11, the Apostle Paul says, to this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. These are the terms that Paul uses for himself. Not a lot of pastors today would be proud of this, but Paul puts this in the Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, the Apostle Paul says, we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure. He was at his wit's end. He was traumatized. He was having trouble coping, so that we despaired of life itself. Now, that's a pretty vulnerable comment. I don't know that Paul is saying I was on the verge of committing suicide, but he did not know if he was going to make it, and he was really worried about it. 2 Corinthians 1:8-9. In chapter 2, verse 4, he says, I wrote you out of great distress and anguish of heart and with many tears, not to grieve you, but to let you know the depth of my love for you. So, you know, Paul loved people so much that he was grieved about their response. Paul was the kind of pastor who worried every Sunday. Now, I'm making this up, but it's right. After he preached his sermon, he wondered if the people liked it. And if they liked it, he went away smiling. And if they didn't, he cried. That's the kind of Paul I think that we see in the letter of 2 Corinthians and Corinthians. And his relationship to the Corinthians was hardly good. It was a mess. In verses 12 to 13, "Now when I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ and found that the Lord had opened a door for me," he's very Calvinistic right now. The Lord has opened a door. He can perceive what God is doing. "I still had no peace of mind because I did not find my brother Titus there. So I said goodbye to them and I went on to Macedonia." So, great opportunity to preach the gospel. He is so upset, he just walks away from it. Now that's a man who is driven some by his emotions and his feelings. And he's vulnerable in expressing this in verses 12 and 13. In chapter 7, verse 2, things come around. He says, now this is a moment of extreme vulnerability by Paul. "Make room for us in your hearts." In other words, he's saying, would you people just like me? Just love me? Just love on me a little bit? Vulnerable. "We have wronged no one. We have corrupted no one. We have exploited no one." So Paul just wants them to like him. Pretty vulnerable. In chapter 11, verses 28 to 29, he says this. You know, after he's listed all his sufferings, which goes on way too long. It's a little over the top, but he's making his point very effectively. "Beside everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn?" That's a pastor. That's a vulnerable pastor of emotions. Now, we can't get into this, but Paul's relationship with the Corinthians is fractured and fizzling and fussy. It's all over the place. And he's having a hard time with these people. And they don't like him. And they criticize him. And I spent way too much time doing this because it was so much fun. Of reading 2 Corinthians 10 through 13 to figure out what the major accusations against Paul were by the Corinthians. And here's what I would tell you. If you got the email with these six things on Monday morning, you'd quit. It's really tough stuff. And it's beyond competency issues. It's character issues and worse. They really get after Paul. And I was working on this because of Adrian Gibson's work on trauma. And I said, I just know there's stuff in 2 Corinthians that works because I had written the Everyday Bible Study on this. So I decided to spend some time just going through these this stuff to find out what his accusations were. And then I began to read some scholarship, and lo and behold, there's some scholars out there who are in the therapy world who are also New Testament scholars and seminary professors who think Paul suffered from PTSD. Now, if you read 2 Corinthians in one sitting, you're going to go like this emotionally. And if you don't go like this, read it again until you do, because it's there. He's up and down. He likes them. He doesn't. They like him. No, he don't. No, they don't. Now, do you like me? Back and forth. And then he has two chapters where he's, chapters 8 and 9, where he's trying to persuade the Corinthians to give some money for the poor saints in Jerusalem. And he doesn't want to persuade them too much, but he uses the Macedonians and the Achaeans as an example of people who do it right, which is a way of saying you need to give money too. So it's sort of like someone raising money and say, I don't want to manipulate you, but I'm gonna. And then chapters 10 to 13 is a completely different tone and tune. And New Testament scholars get into debates about how Paul can move into such a dramatic change of tone and emotion. And some people think that these chapters, 10 through 13, come from another period in Paul's life and has been spliced onto the end of the letter. And other people think fresh news arrived from Corinth and set Paul off. Either way, you got the same result. This is a dramatic shift in tone. All right, what are the allegations? The first one is that he's fickle. He's fickle. Whether Paul could explain himself or not, the critics in Corinth thought the man was fickle because he continued to alter his plans about his arrival. Now, I'm going to read something to you because it's complicated and I don't trust my memory, okay? In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 5, Paul says this, "After I go through Macedonia, which is northern Greece today, I will come to you, for I will be going through Macedonia." Okay? We'll call this plan A. He's in Ephesus. He's going to go through Macedonia, and he's going to come down to Corinth. All right? This is what he wrote. Okay, I read that. All right, don't you just love a plan that says something like this? "I will come to you whenever I cross through Macedonia, for I'm crossing through Macedonia. Perhaps I will remain with you or even spend the winter so you can send me ahead wherever I may go." Don't you just love a leader who says, "Here's our plans whenever we do this, and perhaps we'll do this." And then you sprinkle a little bit of "wherever I may go." Plan A plots a possible trip from Ephesus up through Macedonia, down to Corinth, then off to Jerusalem. But Paul then reconsidered plan A and plotted again plan B. In 2 Corinthians 1:15, he says, "I was deciding," this is now the next letter, "I was deciding to come to you first so you might have double grace," get to see me twice, "and through you to cross into Macedonia." Now he's going to Corinth and then up to Macedonia. "And again for Macedonia to come to you and then come back, and then I'll go to off to Jerusalem." Not bad. This one is a bit more complicated. But instead of plan A or plan B, he actually traveled plan C, which mixes and matches A and B with a little bit more. From Ephesus to Corinth and then back to Ephesus, and then like plan A, by foot north to Troas and then over to Macedonia, and then down to Corinth, and then off to Jerusalem. Now, if you can follow that, you're a New Testament professor. All right? But all I can say is, when they said Paul was fickle, they had good reason. It's difficult to know what he was going to do. And you know what Paul would say? He's a charismatic, you know. He'd say, "This is what the Spirit led me to do." And you're going, "I'm type A, buddy. Get your plans straight and stick to it." Was he fickle? Maybe. Maybe. And I don't think this was Paul's most worrisome criticism, but he does bring it up in two different letters. So it obviously bugged him that they were criticizing him for changing his plans. Now, a second criticism is that there were two Pauls. There were two Pauls. Take the opening verse of 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. "By the humility and gentleness of Christ." Now, that's a way of grabbing them and saying, I'm doing everything right here. "I appeal to you." And now the NIV does a nice job translating this. "I, Paul, who am timid when faced," you know, this is, what's the guy on Saturday Night Live? Timid. What's his name? Chris Farley. "Paul, who am timid when face to face with you, but bold toward you went away." So here's this perception that when Paul's around, he's really kind of a milquetoast. But when he gets to big city Ephesus, he writes these nasty letters back to us. Which Paul is it? So he's Mr. Timid at times and he's Mr. Bold at other times. The Greek word translated timid, praoutes, could also indicate impoverishment and self-impoverishment in a more economical sense, Or it just might point to humility as a feature of his character. But neither self-impoverishment nor humility were virtues for the Corinthians. They were so Roman and so wannabe Roman that they did not like Paul's Christ-like behaviors. They thought he lacked manliness. Boldness, even brashness, were virtues for them. Another time, Paul says this, they say his presence is unimpressive when he speaks, but his letters are weighty and forceful. Chapter 10, verses 10 through 11. Now, their accusations against Paul grew out of a culture of manliness, which was characteristic of Rome, Greece, and Corinth. And Corinth was a city in Greece, of course, but it felt like it was Rome. They wanted to be like the Romans. And they measured people's manliness on the battlefield, in oratory at the rostrum, in public debates, capacities to take a stand in leading a city, victory on the athletic field, or perfection of the body. And they saw Paul as none of the above. He hadn't done the things that were needed. He wasn't athletic enough. He wasn't tough enough. He wasn't bold enough. And they didn't like it. Instead, the image into which Paul wanted to be formed was an image of the Lord Jesus Christ who had been crucified. And they found this to be disgusting, or at least unappealing for leaders. That Paul could quote, he could quote that song in Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 11, as the paradigm of how to relate to one another was painful for the Corinthians. So Paul was basically accused of being a sissy by the Corinthians. He was Mr. Timid kind of leader when he was present. And they criticized him for this, and Paul did not let it go. He brought it up several times in his letters. So Paul's beginning to express signs of being traumatized. Now, a third one is he didn't look the part. The ancient world was often shaped by what is called a science called physiognomy. And that is the correlation of a person's body with their character. All right. So Suetonius writes a famous book called The Lives of the 12 Caesars. And at the end of most of his many biographies of Roman emperors, he describes the body of the emperor. And that body in literary form is expressing the character of the person that he had sketched. Tall, handsome people get hired faster than the opposite. People with long, flowing flocks of hair do well. And they get hired sooner and they move up the ranks faster. Attractive women experience this far more than men. Women experience this. You know, when I got up this morning, I did not care what I looked like. Women leaders in churches don't do that. There are extensive studies about the trauma that women can experience in churches by their body because of the way people talk about them. I have been teaching for 41 years, and apart from one comment, no one has ever made a statement about what I wear or what I look like. And when I went bald, I used to have long hair. No kidding, I did. Not as long as some of yours, but I had hair. And no one has ever made a comment to me about it. But no woman will ever experience it this way. But in the first century, what you looked like mattered to the Corinthians. Okay? 2 Corinthians 10:7 reads like this. Now, there's a little bit of discussion about the exegesis here. You are judging by appearances. NIV. All right? Now, this can be debated. This can be seen as ironical. It can be satire. But it is according to some really good scholars, they think that Paul is talking about his body. And he is talking about what he looks like and what they think he looks like. He didn't look the part. He didn't have the body for the leadership position that he thought he had. And there is a text. I think this one is true. There is a text from the second century that provides support for a sarcastic reading of what Paul is saying in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 7, when he says, "You're judging by appearance." And that's sarcastic, probably. In the Acts of Paul and Thecla, we read of Paul's appearance in these words. I don't know if you've ever heard this. "Titus saw Paul coming, a man small in size, bald-headed," notice, "bandy-legged," which means bow-legged, "of noble mien or manner, with eyebrows meeting," so he had a unibrow, "rather hook-nosed, and full of grace." Right? Now, if that's true, which is the second century, is not that far from Paul, probably could have a pretty good memory, it seems to me that Paul was degraded by the Corinthians for his appearance. Now, when you get made fun of by what you look like, it can run pretty deep. You can't do a whole lot about not being 6'4" when you're 5'4". Can't do much about it. Point guards don't become centers on basketball teams because they're not big enough to play in the paint. And I think that it can be said that Paul, when he says something about his thorn in the flesh, he could be talking about his body as well. Now, if you wake up in the morning and you get these three criticisms to start your day. Number one, that you're fickle, unreliable, that you're two-faced, forked tongue, and that you don't look the part, that you're not handsome enough to be a leader, you're probably going to say, "Man, this is a tough crowd." And this was what my student was experiencing at his church, is he was experiencing people who were attacking everything about him. It didn't matter what he did, it wasn't good enough. So Paul is being criticized. And I tell my students, as pastors, do not read this on Monday morning. And don't read it on sabbatical, it might ruin it. Read this when you're about ready to go to your therapist. And you're ready to be vulnerable with someone you can trust. But the next three are even stronger. A fourth one is that Paul was a mediocre talent. This is about his competency as a speaker and leader. Ralph Martin, who wrote one of the most significant commentaries on 2 Corinthians ever, describes the allegations of the Corinthians against Paul in these terms. Paul was no pneumatic person. In other words, he wasn't spirit-filled the way they wanted. He was singularly lacking in demonstrable, charismatic gifts of leadership. Pretty solid convictions on these parts and pretty hard criticisms to take. Paul says that he is not only, he says, some people say, Paul's quoting his opponents, "His letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he's unimpressive." And then the translation is, "His speaking amounts to nothing." Now, if you fashion yourself as a preacher and someone tells you, "You're horrible," it's not a good day. It's hard. And Paul's getting blasted by the Corinthians. This criticism of his speaking skills stabbed his heart so much, he'll bring it up again in the next chapter. If you read it carefully, you will see that this time he concedes some of their point. "Even if I am self-taught in word," he says. In other words, "I didn't go to seminary. I can't exegete the text the way they did at Dallas Seminary. I can't read Hebrew the way other people read it. I have a funny pronunciation because I didn't grow up in Jerusalem. And they're making fun of his talent. Now, the Corinthians also were used to having famous speakers come through. They did not have ESPN 1, ESPN 2, ESPN U, ESPN whatever. They have them all. All these that we can watch, all we want. Their sports were the Olympics and public contests. And their entertainment was to go listen to public speakers and to go to performances in the theaters. And they were used to hearing good speakers. And then Paul shows up and they're thinking, guy just doesn't have it. And it was painful for Paul because he was burdened to preach the gospel, but he knew that he did not have the verbal skills that they asked. He says very much this in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. At the beginning of the last chapter of 2 Corinthians, however, Paul repeats his lack of skills accusation with what another expression that probably shows that they went even deeper with his skills as preaching. He says, he's quoting a barbed comment, since you are demanding proof that Christ is speaking through me. So they're basically saying in your sermons, Christ is not speaking through you. I'm not hearing the Lord when you're talking. I mean, this is awful if you're a preacher. You imagine what this is like. I can tell you, as a seminary professor, I have called students into my office and I've said, this is a trusting relationship. I've said, I don't think you have the skills to be a preacher. Besides this, I remember telling one student, you don't even like people. It's painful when someone thinks that their gift is preaching and you know it's not. And you have to tell them this. Now, Paul thinks his gift is preaching, and evidently he's doing okay. These churches are popping up everywhere he goes. And yet the Corinthians don't think he has the sophisticated skills of a public rhetorician that they were used to. So they criticized him. And you know who they liked? Apollos. They liked Apollos, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And they liked Peter. And Paul was probably the third best preacher on staff at Corinth. And he wouldn't even take money from them, which bugged them even more. So Paul is alienated from the Corinthians, and they're leveling all kinds of accusations against this guy for his preaching. So it didn't work. A fifth accusation against Paul was he didn't act the part. He was afraid to boast of his accomplishments. And this, I just want to mention this. The Corinthians believed that boasting, the Romans, the Greeks, they believed in boasting. Josephus brags about himself all the time. And one of the most famous documents of the first century is a document that's in major cities, and it's a magnification of the emperor's accomplishments in history. All right. If you had accomplished something and you were unwilling to tell people what you had accomplished, you didn't deserve the accomplishments. So boasting was expected of people who were successful. And Paul refuses to boast. In fact, when he boasted, you know what he boasted about? All the wrong things. He boasts in 2 Corinthians, like, you want me to boast? Okay, I'm going to boast. And he's just getting it right to their face. I'll boast about my suffering. You know, I've been shipwrecked all these times. I've been beaten. It's like in our barbers, I used to go to a barber. It's been a while. It takes now 3 minutes for my wife to cut my hair. All right. So there was this sign at our barber shop. It was a dog. It said, missing one leg, blind in one eye, lost an ear, scars on his back, answers to the name Lucky. If you looked at Paul's body, you would say, wow. I'm sure he had bones that were broken. You've seen former football players, the NFL, they hold their hands out and their fingers go in six different directions because they're all broken. Paul was the kind of, had the kind of body that evinced a lot of suffering, and he bragged about it. But he's only doing this to shove it in their face for that. You want boasting? Okay, I'll boast. And that's his attitude. Paul plays favorites. Another criticism. They did not like it that he took money from the Achaeans right in front of them in Corinth, but wouldn't take money from them because Paul would only receive funds from churches that were self-dependent and autonomous. And the Corinthians were not, so he wouldn't take their money. They wanted to employ him so that they could brag that they had a philosopher of their own, and Paul wouldn't take the money. Finally, this is maybe the most damaging of all the criticisms of Paul. He was no longer special, and he was one among many. They claimed that they were equal, and he calls them, with nothing other than labeling, Paul calls them uber apostles or super apostles. They think they're something super cool. And they called themselves equal to Paul, and they had gained the favor of lots of people in Corinth, and Paul was now the founding member of the founder of this church, and at the same time, they no longer respected him. Now, the only way that a human body responds to this many criticisms of your pastoral leadership when you value pastoral leadership is trauma. And this letter shows all the signs of trauma. Paul, you know what the symptoms of trauma are? You fight, you go into flight, you freeze, or you fawn. You fight back, you flee, you freeze. Paul never froze at anything, I don't think. And you fawn. And I'm going to talk about fawning in just a second here. All right. Throughout 2 Corinthians 10 through 13, Paul is fighting back. He offers the criticism, and then he defends himself. And then he says, I'm not defending myself. And we're going, oh, yes, you are. And then he flees. He goes off to Ephesus twice, at least twice. He sends Timothy, you go take him on. Titus, you go take him on. And he's staying in Ephesus writing nasty letters to him. And then they have to cover up all his messes that he's making in Corinth, Timothy and Titus do. So Paul has fled. And I don't think he froze, but he fawned. And he fawned in a Christian way. Fawning is to become, is to capitulate to the people. And this is serious business. Traumatized people can become so traumatized and so dependent upon the people who are traumatizing them that they just completely cave into the people. And it's a painful situation. Therapeutically, it's very difficult. Paul fawns in a different way. Okay, you want me to boast? Okay, I'll fawn to your style. And he flips it completely and says, I am going to take all refuge in Christ suffering himself. So he theologically fawns, but he's playing the game of fawning when he's not really fawning, if that makes sense to you. So what can we do about this? These are some of the principles that we're going to develop in our book on how to respond to people, if I can find all these. The first thing I would say is that I believe pastors need to have a therapist. Okay? What's that? Preach. Preach. Okay, that one's going over really well. All right. I think pastors need to realize that fighting back, I think, this is what I believe, I think if you fight back in your churches today, you're probably going to make things worse, but it's okay. Paul, I think, is a fair model of this, is that sometimes you have to defend yourself. Now, even if you have to say, I'm not defending myself, you probably are. But you see in the Apostle Paul that he has to fight back for his own integrity to be maintained, because there's nobody else going to bat for him. Now, eventually, probably Titus and Timothy did some work for him. I think we have to work on our cultures in order to build safe environments. We need to know what the triggers are. And we need to recognize that people in our churches who are traumatized, we're going to see in them anger. Paul is angry. Sarcasm is angry. There's a whole dissertation written on sarcasm in Paul's letters. He's pretty sarcastic with the Corinthians. When you're being sarcastic with people, you're expressing something more than just what you say. And he's ironical. And irony is to say something you're not saying by words that convey what you're saying. And Paul does this quite a bit in these letters. So he's fighting back with sarcasm and sometimes with irony. And I think it's okay to say that. But I would also say it's okay to be angry. And I have told this student of mine that I've worked with through this situation of his, and I've done it with more than one student who are pastors, it's okay to be angry. Just don't lash out in the pulpit at them. Be angry in your back room. Scream in the garden. Yell somewhere, but probably not going to help in the church if you start blasting away at people. But anger, if you're angry, you're angry. There's nothing wrong with anger. Okay? It's your emotion. Your body's telling you something with this. You're angry about it. And it's all right to be angry, and Paul expresses this. So to me, Paul is someone that you and I can go to when we're in the midst of trauma and say, Paul, you've been where I am. Thank you for telling us the way you feel. It's good to be with people who've been traumatized as they express their trauma.
Thanks for listening to the Together PDX podcast. I hope you found Scott's content both challenging and encouraging today. Just a reminder, this was a recording of a live gathering in Portland, Oregon for pastors, leaders, and anyone else who wants to hear from world-class theologians. We call these gospel gatherings, and we do them about once a quarter. We have an amazing lineup in 2025, starting with N.T. Wright here in person in February. So check out this and more at togetherpdx.org/events.